Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. We've talked about Elon Musk's plans to merge two of his own companies into one mega venture that will push his network to $800 billion. And here's what his world's richest man competitors, Jeff Bezos, is up to. Bezos owns the Washington Post, which announced it is laying off one-third of its workforce. The BBC reported that executive editor Matt Murray said the cuts would bring stability. But the announcement was met with condemnation from many. Here's more.
Political analyst Mark Sandolo, Mark himself a veteran of the newspaper wars for many a year. Mark, I don't know, we hear about newspapers shutting down, but there's something about the Post, you know, being one of our newspapers of record, cutting this many jobs, yeah. It just really hits hard.
I mean, the Post has been around for, next year it'll be its 150th birthday, and, you know, they're known, Woodward and Bernstein and Watergate and dozens of other stories. You know, this is... it's not the end of journalism, but clearly newspapers are dying a slow and almost complete death at this point. When I first moved to town, and I came to town to be the bureau chief in the San Francisco Chronicle, where I worked for a couple of decades, the Washington Post had a circulation of over a million on Sundays, 850,000 every day. Now it's under 100,000. You got to be an old guy to be, or an old woman, to still be reading newspapers. And I say that carefully for anybody who's reading newspapers out there. You know, I teach college students. None of them pick up a printed newspaper. And it's very understandable. It's an old technology. But, you know, the same way that, you know, we saw LPs come and go, and 8-tracks and cassettes and DVRs come and go, music didn't die with them. It was the means of expressing it. So news and journalism isn't dying. It's just that the business model of selling ads on print and selling them and distributing them to people's doorsteps is no longer viable. And unfortunately, the digital ads don't make the same kind of money. And what's very disappointing about the Post is it was bought a few years ago by, I don't know if he's the richest man in the world right now, but Jeff Bezos, one of the richest men. He's worth like something like a quarter of $1 trillion. So the Post is losing $100 million a year. That's untenable. Doesn't change Bezos's life at all. But now the Post is going to restructure itself. And for anyone who reads the Post, it's really gone downhill over the last year, as many, many columnists and news reporters has left, as they have seemed to be much more, they've seemed to cut back on their criticism of President Trump now that Bezos is in charge. But that said, they're going to focus completely on digital now. They're basically burning the people of Washington by cutting its local desk. So, you know, something happens in Maryland or in D.C. or Virginia, people know less about it. The sports page, incredibly, is going to be done away with. They say they're going to keep some of their reporters. I don't know what that means for those of us who go to Nationals games or others who go to Commanders games. But this is a very sad day in Washington, but it's a sign of what's going on all around the country.
Yeah, I think you made a good point. It's not the end of journalism, but, you know, there is legacy media, whether it's newspaper or, you know, the evening newscasts that the networks have on television. Just not as many consumers, but it is being replaced with other newer technology.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can go on the internet now and find out, you know, anything about everything pretty quickly. It may not be accurate, but at least you have access to incredible amounts of information. And that's going to be, you know, remarkable coming up in the future. But there's another truth to it, which is always hard to admit, you know, on the radio. Radio and television broadcast, and for that matter, a lot of the internet services rely on the groundwork that newspapers do. You know, you pick up the newspaper in the morning and the New York Times has reported something and everyone reads that. There's a reason that, you know, the San Francisco Chronicle still has a larger staff than KCBS does. It's because it is easier. There, you know, you don't have to buy equipment. You don't have to buy satellite times. You don't have to buy phones to do live recordings. A lot of print journalists did the legwork that other media relied on. So as these newspapers cut back, the production of news, you know, does tend to slow down. Somebody is going to figure out a way to monetize this in the future, because there's incredible potential for the future of journalism with, you know, with surround cameras and being able to walk down the street and instant translations. There's a great future for journalism. It's just the business model as we know it is dead. And as a result, we're saying things like, you know, the Washington Post. The fact that there's not going to be a Washington Post sports page anymore, remarkable.
So what's the future of journalism in a digital world? Here's Rob Hart.
We welcome in David Greising, President and CEO of the Better Government Association based in Chicago. David, thank you for joining us today. And one common theme when talking about disruption in media is exchanging broadcast dollars for digital dimes. And in the grand old days of the newspaper industry, a lot of the coverage that made a great deal of difference to citizens and how they viewed their government and how their leaders were held accountable was essentially subsidized by full-page ads for Marshall Fields and Weebolts and Crocs and Brentanos. And print journalism, now digital journalism, never really found a way to replace those traditional ad dollars.
No, they haven't. And you didn't mention, of course, the classified advertising, which was also a huge, high profit part of newspaper publication. Rob, since the days you talked about, the number of newspaper jobs in the state of Illinois is down by about 85%. We've seen dozens and dozens of newspapers close. And in the latest news, this is in the context of big publications like the Washington Post having this huge reduction, 30% of its staff. But we've seen also a diminution in our local market. The Chicago Tribune is down substantially from those old days that you made reference to. And of course, the Sun-Times and National Public Radio outlet WBEZ merged and turned the Sun-Times into a nonprofit. So we're in a period of incredible flux, and all of it's happening as the advent of artificial intelligence will put additional pressure on all news organizations because AI is taking a lot of search traffic away. And so that was the way a lot of readers found places like the Washington Post and some of our local outlets. And that path is going to be less useful to each one of us, including the Better Government Association. We published the Illinois Answers Project, and we're facing the same challenges everybody else faces.
I'd love to talk about the good old days, and maybe the good old days were indeed better, but let's talk about the future. The Washington Post is now trying to reorient itself around political coverage and national security coverage, and of course, Washington, you can make a lot of money from unique advertisers trying to lobby lawmakers, and unfortunately, that means their international coverage and their sports coverage has to go under this realignment. But where do you see the future of digital and print journalism going? Because it was those big print newsrooms that had the resources to do the investigations and could afford the lawyers to back them up.
Very few will continue to try to be everything to everybody. In this local market, we are fortunate to still have two strong local newspapers that are still trying to serve this purpose. But it'll be interesting to see whether others follow the Washington Post, which is now really narrowing its focus. And other publications have, here in the local market, have gotten very, very focused. There's a group called Injustice Watch that just does investigative reporting about courts coverage. Block Club Chicago has become very popular, but they made their mark by covering neighborhood news that nobody else was covering. We've got a group called Borderless that covers immigration issues exclusively, and Chalkbeat covers education exclusively. So it'll be more of a specialization. It'll be up to readers to kind of look in the right place for the kind of news that they like.
We never like to leave you on a down note, so here's something uplifting, very uplifting.
I'm WWJ Autobeat reporter Jeff Gilbert. Marathons are very difficult, but at 22,000 feet, are they even possible? 10 runners are going to find out. Ford is also going to help them by providing support vehicles. Let's go to Chile now. We're talking to Paul Gurney, Aldo Kane. They're joining us. So tell us about this world's highest marathon.
Amazing. So we're here in Chile at a place called Ojos del Salado to attempt the world's highest marathon. It is a marathon done from over 22,000 feet. So it's going to involve our team of 10 people with 6 support team, a film crew heading up to the summit of this mountain, and then attempting a full marathon all the way back down.
So at least you're going downhill, but I mean, at that height, it is a lot of exertion. I've been half that height and I was gasping for air.
Yeah, listen, this is unbelievably difficult. its altitude, we've only got about 44% of the oxygen. It's going to be about minus 13 Fahrenheit with wind chill on top of that. So we could have 60 mile an hour winds. And yeah, the run is going to be extraordinarily difficult. And in truth, we're not sure if we can do this. It's incredibly hard.
Has it been tried before?
The current world record was set from the summit of Kilimanjaro. That's at about 19,000 feet. And it also finishes a lot lower. So that finishes down at about 6,000 feet. We're finishing over 12,500. So this has never been attempted at this altitude before. So we're hopeful. And, you know, we're here with some amazing Ford vehicles taking us up the mountain and putting us in the very best position we can be in.
Yeah, and tell me about how the Ford vehicles are involved.
Yeah, so we, it's Aldo here. for an expedition like this, we could not do it without vehicle support. So we're using two Ford Raptors, and we've got one Expedition and one Everest. And we are also, to add into this record of the highest marathon, we're also looking to get another record where we do the highest swing in altitude of a vehicle. So from sea level a few days ago up to hopefully around 6,000 meters. Or about 19,000 feet. But yeah, so we're going to use Raptor 1 for this trip up the mountain, and it's been they've been great support vehicles so far.
And in terms of doing that, you know, we all know what the altitude does to the human body, but how tough is it on an automobile?
Well, it's incredibly difficult. These vehicles are off the peg Ford Raptors that you can buy in any store. And so they've not been tuned. They've not had any work done to them to help them at the altitude. So we are really going to be pushing them to the absolute limits there. But yeah, like I say, without these vehicles, we wouldn't be able to do either the marathon or the high altitude record in the vehicles.
And if I could ask this one question to both of you, it's a simple question, but it's what's going to be going through everybody's head. From an individual standpoint, why are you doing this? You personally?
Yeah, so I'll pick up. I mean, I run a company called Becoming Expert. It's all about helping people achieve extraordinary things. And what we really want to do here is showcase human potential. This is phenomenally tough. I mean, we've got a group of elite athletes, ultra endurance athletes, adventurers, and complete amateurs. And really what I want to do is show people that they have got the ability to do amazing things with the right training, the right support. You know, you can do extraordinary things. And Aldo, what's your reason?
Yeah, for me, I've spent my life and certainly the last 30 years living, working and operating in extreme remote and hostile locations. But certainly over the last 5 or 10 years, I've been using my profile and what I do to inspire others to basically get outside, and start challenging themselves. So, and I basically, do what I say that others should do. And that's exactly what this is.
And I take it both of you are experienced marathoners, but at a lower level.
Aldo, you go first.
I've never ran a textbook marathon, although I have done multiple days of very long distances. So this will be my first official marathon, and if we're successful, it will be the highest marathon that's ever been ran.
So I have done several marathons before, and in fact, we just broke the world record for the world's deepest marathon. We ran a marathon over 3,000 feet below sea level in a mine in Sweden. So I'm by no means a good runner by any measure, but I've certainly done some quite adventurous ones in the past. But this one, by no means, you know, this is extraordinary, and this one will no doubt be the toughest one I'll ever do.
Now, is the base camp that you're at the highest level, so you'll start at that level and go down?
No, so our base camp, we're up where we're sitting now. We're actually sitting in one of our Ford Raptors to get out of the wind at the moment. But we're at about 13,000 feet at the moment. So we're in a beautiful, beautiful lake location. But, you know, the mountain is looming above us. So we actually drive up, believe it or not. We drive about 30 miles all through sort of tracks and terrain to get us to almost 17,000 feet, at which point we'll get out and trek. We'll trek for, we'll climb for about 9 hours just to get to the start line. So we leave at 11 o'clock at night, trek through the night, freezing, freezing temperatures. And then hopefully at about 7 a.m., all being well, we will start the marathon and then head back down.
Who needs sleep?
Absolutely. It's genuinely, this could be 18 to 24 hours on our feet. We really don't know how long this will take.
I think what's important with this one as well, Jeff, is that we genuinely don't know at this point whether this is possible for us to do this. The air at that height at 22,500 feet is approximately 40-odd% of oxygen in the air, so well below half the amount of air we have at sea level. So even just moving and picking up a bag and you know, moving 10 feet makes you very, very, very tired.
And the vehicles will be on standby just in case somebody has a problem?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the vehicles are really integral to this. As I said, we're taking them up 16, 17,000 feet, and they really provide the support throughout this. So, you know, it can be minus 10, minus 15 outside. Any issues, you can jump in the car. We've got lovely heated seats in here. So, you know, it's going to be amazing. They're going to be driving up and down, making sure we're all supported. But, you know, huge, huge team challenge for all of us.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.